The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have another memorial edition of the Best of the Book Nook coming your way this morning as we revisit an interview I did back in 2000 with the astronaut Eugene Cernan, the last human to walk on the moon, who died recently at the age of 82. He was the commander of the Apollo 17 lunar landing mission in 1972, and we'll revisit our interview with the late Gene Cernan right after NPR News. Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And last Saturday, we ran a memorial edition of the Best of the Book Nook, paying tribute to the late Nat Hentoff, who had died at the age of 91. He was a cultural critic, an authority on jazz and on the First Amendment, and we brought you that interview as a remembrance of his brilliance. And this week, unfortunately, we have another memorial program to bring you. I've lost another author from the Book Nook archives. Back in the day, I collected interviews with some of my heroes, the early American astronauts. We had John Glenn on the program, who passed away recently, and we brought you that interview again. We had Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon, on the program twice. And Gene Cernan appeared back in 2000. He died recently at the age of 82. He was the last human to walk on the moon. And he was coming to Dayton to talk about a book called The Last Man on the Moon, Astronaut Eugene Cernan and America's Race in Space. He was also coming to town to be entered into the Aviation Hall of Fame, which gave me the excuse and the pretext to get a phone interview with him. And as you listen to this interview, I hope you enjoy the sound quality of it, because we have seen a decline in sound quality on phone interviews with the proliferation of cell phones. He was on one of those trustworthy copper landlines back in the day. We're going to revisit our interview now with Eugene Cernan, the last human to walk on the moon, who died at the age of 82 recently, and this was originally recorded on July 10th, 2000. It's the Best of the Book Nook.
Well, you've got, you got your claim to fame. Of course, Neil is from Wapakoneta, and so, you've got the top of the pack there.
And that's actually right at the edge of our listening area here. I understand, isn't he in Lebanon these days, Lebanon, Ohio?
Neil?
Yeah.
Armstrong, yeah, is somewhere, he's got a little farm, I think, somewhere near Cincinnati.
Uh-huh.
And that's where he's been for a long time. I talk to Neil quite a bit and see him quite a bit, and he's been there for quite a while.
You guys met at Purdue.
Well, we didn't really know each other that well at Purdue. Neil, couple years older than I am, and actually flew in Korea and came back and finished up, I think, in 55 at Purdue, and I just went right out of high school to Purdue, and I finished there in 56, and I'd met him. I knew the lady he married, who was from Purdue at the same time, and it's ironic. Little did we know at that time that Purdue would one day have the opportunity to claim the first steps and the last steps on the surface of the moon.
Your dad really wanted you to go to a good engineering school, didn't he?
Yeah, he wanted me to get the education, Vic, that he never got. I owe a great deal to my dad. He probably ought to be up there in Dayton this Saturday receiving, being enshrined into the Hall of Fame, because he's really the one who deserves it.
Tell us how you fell in love with flying and how that all came about.
Well, I'm old enough to have been a product of World War II. By that I mean I was born in 1934, and I grew up as a grade school kid during the Second World War years, and just got infatuated with aviation and flying. Although I had a stipulation, I wanted to fly airplanes off aircraft carriers. That maybe it was from watching all the newsreels in the Pacific, or you know, the John Wayne movies of those of that era, and Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima, and you know, those kind of movies. And my goal was someday, sometime, given an opportunity, I want to fly airplanes off aircraft carriers. Now, I wasn't sure how I was going to get there when I was in third or fourth or fifth grade, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. That was, you know, everyone's got to have a dream, and I guess that was mine as a kid growing up.
And that dream eventually led you to actually meet John Wayne.
Well, I did, yeah, as I did later on, and, you know, he's, as I say, next to my dad, maybe he's my next special hero, and he was all in person what I think what he appears to has appeared to most of us in films.
My guest is Captain Eugene Cernan. His book is The Last Man on the Moon. Now, you knew the requirements to become an astronaut, but you never dreamed it would happen to you, and then one day you got a phone call.
Well, you know, I just I've always taken life in sort of 5-year increments as growing up. To get where I wanted to go, and I was in the Navy to fly airplanes, I had to somehow get a college education. My dad obviously was very influential in that, and very influential in me going to Purdue. Which was obviously, in retrospect, the right thing to do, and I went through Naval ROTC at Purdue, and that was my stepping stone in aviation. And you know, once I got into the Navy, I was committed to 5 years service, which didn't bother me a bit because I was you know, a bachelor, young, invisible and bulletproof in those days, and all I wanted to do was fly. And quite frankly, after that, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And when I had served my 5 years, made a couple cruises off aircraft carriers in the Western Pacific. This is the pre-Vietnam War days. The Navy said, "No, we don't want you to get out. Why don't you stay around? And we want to send you to school, get a little bit more education." And so I thought that might not be a bad idea. I just got married, and they wanted to send me up to Monterey, Carmel, California, which, you know, to most people, is God's country, and get a postgraduate, get an advanced degree at the Naval Postgraduate School up there. And so that's what I did, and that was about the time when Alan Shepard and John Glenn were beginning to fly, Gus Grissom, the very, very beginning of America's manned space program. And I was so far removed from that. I wasn't old enough, didn't have enough experience, and I remember someone asking me when Shepard flew back in 1961 how I'd like to do that, and I'd say I'd love it, but by the time I'm qualified, all the pioneering will be over. There won't be anything left to do. And little did I know, 3 years later, two and a half years later, I got a telephone call saying from the Navy saying they wanted to recommend me to NASA for further evaluation, and you know, it just blew me away. It was sort of like that letter I got wondering if I would accept enshrinement into the National Aviation Hall of Fame. Both of those events in my life blew me away.
Hmm.
Probably interrelated at that.
I'd say so. Weren't you one of like 400 guys who were trying to get into it?
Well, I think, you know, at that time there were probably a couple thousand civilians that had applied, and several, probably well over 100 military people that had been recommended by the military. I didn't apply because indeed I did not meet NASA's requirements. But the Navy went ahead and recommended me anyway. And so when we got to Houston, there were about 80, I think as I remember, 86 military folks, and the rest probably 350 civilians. And by that time, we'd already gone through several batteries of written tests and so forth, and then were invited to Houston for interviews and and all kinds of interesting. No medical physicals yet at that point in time, but all kinds of interesting events down here in order to weed people out. And I went down to Houston, and I came down here that very first time and looked around, and I couldn't really understand why I was here, because I was surrounded by the most qualified people in aviation, people who had combat records, people who had finest test pilots, flew faster, flew higher, flew further than anyone else. And I figured, well, at least maybe I'll get to meet John Glenn and Al Shepard and Wallace Schirra and a few of the other guys and go home and tell my grandkids I once met an astronaut. Went through that battery of 4 or 5 days of intensive and very interesting interrogations, if you will, and was sent home and was told, don't you call me, I'll call you. And lo and behold, about 3 weeks later, I got another call inviting me back down and to Houston. And when I got down this time, about three-quarters of those can't-miss guys were even there. I mean, and I still was, and still a long way from ever getting involved in the space program. But that went on for about 6 months, and I ended up to be one of 14 guys selected, and I guess the rest is history. Because even after you get selected for the program, there's no guarantee you're ever going to fly. And I guess the best way I can respond to the kind of questions that I have when people say, did you ever think you'd get to go to the moon, is I spent 2.5 years writing my book, and of course I read chapter after chapter and re-edited it as a writer. When it was all said and done, I figured, I saw it on a bookshelf counter one day, and I said, maybe I ought to read it as a reader. And Vic, I did, and I mean this in all due humility. I wondered who I was writing about after I read the book. I said, who is this guy who's been so lucky and has had so many opportunities and had a chance to do some of the things he's done in his lifetime beyond all expectations of a dream?
I'll say you've been lucky. Reading your book reminded me a little bit of reading John Glenn's book because of all those close calls you guys seem to have. It's just amazing. Let's talk about that first flight. You guys were so competitive about getting on these flights, and you finally got on one.
Well, yeah, out of the 14, I was really scheduled to be the fifth guy to fly, which would have been the last guy of my group to fly in Gemini, which would have been terrific for me. And of course, accidents occur along the way, and Tom Stafford and I were backing up the Gemini 9 crew. Charlie Bassett and Elliot C., and they had a mishap and killed themselves in an airplane up at St. Louis, so we took over their job and flew Gemini 9. I say job over their opportunity or adventure, whatever you want to call it, because that's what it all became. And I ended up to be the second guy in our 14 to fly, and the second American ever to, third human being, second American ever to open hatch and get out of a spacecraft and walk in space. And up until that time, we had a grand total of, I think, 20 minutes of space walking experience. And my goal was to be out there almost 3 hours and fly what I call a Buck Rogers backpack right out of the 21st century around, like we see being done on shuttle today. But this is back in 1966, and I want to promise you, we really didn't know much about what we were doing in those areas. And that chapter or two in my book is, and I think it devoted more than one to it, I call it the Spacewalk from Hell. And it was, yeah, it got a little hairy, and probably more so as I went, reflected upon the events and went through the tapes and listened to my own voice and read more of the reports as I wrote my book. And I began to look back even now, 20, 25 years later. I probably should have been scared at the time, but probably wasn't smart enough.
You say you were exerting yourself, if I recall, it was about 117 stair steps a minute exertion?
Oh, I don't know. I think someone helped me equate that. I was out there floating around, and not so much floating around, but what I had to do, I had to go behind the outside the Gemini spacecraft out in what we call the adapter section, and our spacesuits at that point in time were just... We're so rudimentary. They were survival suits, effectively, and when you pressurized them, it was like you just covered yourself with a sheet of plaster or Paris. It was very hard to move your arms and your legs, and then most important, your fingertips, which you needed so badly. And I had to go back there and assemble basically assemble this little flying machine that I was going to strap on my back and go whizzing around the sky. And I had to do it with no footholds or nothing in the way of handholds. I couldn't. In zero gravity, every time you turn a valve, it turns back. It's, you know, I equated it to like opening a Coca-Cola out there with one hand, taking the top off a Coke with one hand or something. You just, every time you move, you get pushed away and floating in space. And my heart rate was pounding at about 170 beats a minute for well over an hour. I went around the world at 18,000 miles an hour, and we're doing this in daylight and darkness. And as I said, we were pretty ambitious. I overpowered my environmental control system. My spacesuit got all fogged up, and it was like a cold winter morning. I know I grew up in Illinois, so Ohio is not much different. You go out there in the morning, and the first thing you do is breathe, and your windshield freezes up, and That's basically what happened to my spacesuit, my visor, and it turned out to be pretty interesting, Vic.
You really wanted to get that pack on and do what you were supposed to do, and as it turned out, you didn't do that. What did it feel like when you threw away that $10 million piece of equipment?
Well, I tell you, dollars and cents didn't make a lot of sense. I disappointed. Once you're given a job, you got a commitment, you want to get the job done. Although I knew I was pushing myself further into a corner, and the people on the ground knew that also, and the doctors could see my heart rates and knew the kind of workload I was putting out, and quite frankly, I was getting pretty tired, but was unwilling to admit it. You know, and you only come this way once, at least. Who knows? Who knew whether I'd ever fly again? And I just was given a job I just wanted to do, and yet I knew that had I gone every step I took a little bit further in the direction of strapping that thing on, man, I had to unstrap it. And in retrospect, probably had I gone much further, we might have ended up, there might have been some catastrophic results. I don't want to overplay that particularly, but we were getting into a hole that I'm afraid we weren't going to. I say we, I guess I would have been the end. You know, I was at the end of the string, so may not have been able to dig myself out of.
You would have been satellite CERN-ing.
Well, I might have been. That's possible. We laugh about it today, but before we left on that flight, just to, you know, so we all knew what the grounders were, we didn't talk too much about them. But quite frankly, if I could not have gotten in back in the spacecraft, which was another almost another whole chapter in the book, because that was like putting a champagne cork back into a champagne bottle. You know, I came out easy, but as soon as you come out, your suit stiffens up. It's very difficult to bend back up like a pretzel and get in and close that hatch, because the Gemini spacecraft was so very, very small. People who, you know, or readers who might have seen one will know what I'm talking about. But we had an unwritten rule that if I couldn't get back in or had a problem out there, Tom Stafford had no choice but to sort of cut me loose and close that hatch, or try and close that hatch by himself, and come back home alone. Now, we laugh about that today, Tom and I do, but the fact of life is we didn't talk too much about it at the time, but yet we knew that those were some of the kind of unwritten rules that we had to work under. We were working, we had a goal at that point in time, and the Gemini was a bridge to that goal from the first flights of Glenn and Shepard to those flights in Apollo, which eventually got us to Moon. And Gemini was the bridge we had to cross. We had to learn so much about what we didn't know. And in order to do that, we had to take a few chances. There were no guarantees. You know, the risk and reward had to be measured against each other. We didn't go out there to be martyrs, but we went out there to do something we believed in. And we sort of took some of those chances in stride, as I say, and we were smart enough, and we had our ticker tape parades along the way, but we sure paid for our mistakes dearly, and in some cases with the loss of the lives of our colleagues. But we knew certain things had to be done, and we were given a challenge by the president, not just to get to the moon by the end of the decade, but the unwritten part of that challenge was to get there before the Soviets got there at that point in time. And that was a world we were living in.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, an interview I recorded back in July of 2000. Some of you might recall that back in those days, The Book Nook came your way every weekday afternoon during the 2 o'clock hour, and that was one of those interviews from that period. We're talking to Gene Cernan about his book, The Last Man on the Moon. He was coming to town for a book signing and to be inducted into the Aviation Hall of Fame. And he died recently at the age of 82. We'll continue our interview with Gene Cernan right after this. You're listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, a memorial program today in honor of Eugene Cernan, the last human to walk on the moon, who died recently at the age of 82. I had him on the program back in July of 2000. He was coming to town because he had a book out called The Last Man on the Moon, Astronaut Eugene Cernan and America's Race in Space, and he was going to be inducted into the Aviation Hall of Fame. Let's continue now with my interview with Gene Cernan on WYSO. What was it like to meet your Soviet counterpart, the first spacewalker? You guys really had a little bond there, didn't you?
Yeah, Alexei Leonov and I, he was the first human being outside of a spacecraft. Did it about, as I say, I think about a month before Ed White went out. Ed was out for 20 minutes. Alexei was only out for 12, and by his own admission today, he wouldn't have said it then, but by his own admission today, you know, he spent 3 minutes getting out of that spacecraft and 9 minutes just trying to survive and get back in, fighting for his life. But when you're one of two or three or four guys in those early years who did something unique and different, there is a bond there because you both know what it feels like, you both know what it looked like. And Alexei and I today have become very, very, very good personal friends, our families, our daughters and everything, and he's just one heck of a guy. He eventually flew the Apollo-Soyuz mission, but was slated to be one of the first men on their flight, a crew member on their first flight to the moon, which never occurred because we got there first.
Your book is filled with insights into the personalities of all these guys who were doing this with you, and I really love the picture that you draw of Alan Shepard and the incident that you describe where you went in and you basically put it all on the line and you won him as a friend. That's a great story.
Well, I wanted, and that is a story, and, I don't know, repeating it briefly here does not really share the feelings that I think both he and I had, but I'll just say this. Al was my boss for a long time, very hard guy to get to know. My goal after I'd flown Gemini 9 and I went to the moon on Apollo 10, but we didn't land. We took the lunar lander, went down within about 47,000 feet, sort of painted a line in the sky so Apollo 11 crew, so Neil wouldn't get lost on his way and could cover the other 50,000 feet. But it was a great mission. But in coming back, I wanted to go back to the moon, but I just didn't want to go back to walk on the moon. I wanted to go back as commander of my own crew. And I cannot tell you how competitive our business was at that point in time. And perhaps my biggest gamble, I talk about it in the book, is turning down a chance to walk on the moon on Apollo 16 for the potential, not to guarantee by any means again, but just the potential of maybe having an opportunity to get to be commander of a flight down the line. And at that point in time, we didn't know whether there was going to be an Apollo 18, which it turned out there wasn't, or whether 16 was going to be the last or 17 might exist. That was perhaps the biggest gamble I took of all in my career as an astronaut was taking a shot at being of getting a command and turning down a sure opportunity to walk on the moon. And the episode you talk about was walking in Alan's office, still my boss. He was assigned to command Apollo 14, and I was given the assignment of backup commander of Apollo 14, which was backing up Alan Shepard, and then maybe rotating as a commander of some crew further down the line. And I can say with a great deal of certainty that anyone who backed up Alan Shepard at that point in his life when he was commander of Apollo 14 as a backup pilot, I was never going to fly, although I had to be prepared to. And so I just confronted Al at that point in time and not knowing how he was going to respond. And basically told him I wasn't only going to be ready, but I was going to be probably better to do the, being able to do the job better than he was going to be able to do it. And I may be one of the few challenges Alan Shepard has ever had in his life where someone stood up, looked him in the eye, and said he was better than he is, and he stuck out his hand with a big grin and said, Gino, we're going to have a great time, and we did. And that was my fourth flight. The flight I never flew was Apollo 14, but that was really my fourth flight. You know, Vic, my intent in this book was not to tell my story, but was to not just simply to share the experiences, but have them be, in effect, your experiences. I want you to know what it was like to be traveling around the world at 18,000 miles in a spacesuit with your visor fogged up, dangling from the end of a tether from a spacecraft. I wanted you to know what it was like to stand on the surface of the moon and look back home from a quarter of a million miles through the blackness of space. I wanted it to be your experience. I wanted it, you to feel and not have me tell you, but I wanted you to be there, even though you knew what the outcome was. I wanted it to be your experience and not mine. And I think one of the greatest compliments I've had from people is maybe I've accomplished that goal.
Well, I think if you didn't accomplish it, you landed at least a couple of hundred feet from where you planned to land.
Well, I appreciate that. That's a good way of putting it.
My guest is Captain Eugene Cernan. You really do tell it like it is in the book, The Last Man on the Moon. And I wished I'd read this book before I interviewed Buzz Aldrin the first time, because I can remember when I interviewed him saying, now, Buzz, is it possible that you could have been the first man on the moon? And I felt like I struck a nerve, and he got a little agitated with the
question.
Very
sensitive nerve with Buzz, I try.
Yeah. And I learned why by reading this book. So thank you for that.
Well, I just, you know, I didn't. This is not a locker room book or a ball four book or anything else. It's the people I talked about, I had to describe, because these are the colleagues that I live with, that I work with. We were in our own little world, and there were a lot going on outside our world, you know, everything from Woodstock to Vietnam Wars to all kinds of things happening, assassinations and one thing or another. And not that we weren't aware of those, but we were, for good, bad, or indifference, we lived in our own world. We had tunnel vision. We had a job to do, and those things did affect us, but we couldn't let those kind of things get too much of our attention. And therefore, I had to talk about the guys in my world, and I talked to them only from the standpoint of, this is what I saw from where I saw it. Mm-hmm. Now, you can talk to anybody else who was in the program with me at the same time. They may have seen things differently or seen people differently, but that's the way I saw it. And whether it was the Neil Armstrongs or the Buzz Aldrins or the Dick Gordons or the Bill Anders or anybody that I lived and worked, or Tom Stafford that I flew with, these are the guys that I saw from where, in the way I saw them. And it was only meant to share that with people, and no way to take away or add to any of them from a personality point of view. And there were a lot of other instances where there were just one-on-one conversations between me and Shepard or between me and Deke Slayton, which were very, very, very important to me in my life in terms of how I got where I did, that obviously are the way I saw them. And I happen to be only one of two people who were there, so no one can really dispute what I felt at the time and what I tried to describe of the events.
That's Eugene Cernan on The Best of the Book Nook, a memorial tribute to him. He died recently at the age of 82, and we recorded this interview with him back in July of 2000. He had a book out called The Last Man on the Moon. Astronaut Eugene Cernan in America's Race in Space, and he was coming to Dayton to be entered into the Aviation Hall of Fame. For those of you who are not familiar with his exploits as an astronaut, I'd like to share the obituary that appeared in the New York Times. The headline was, Eugene Cernan, last human to walk on moon, dies at 82. Eugene A. Cernan, the commander of the Apollo 17 lunar landing mission in 1972 and the last human to walk on the moon, died on Monday in Houston. He was 82. His death was announced by NASA. A ferocious competitor with a test pilot's reckless streak, Mr. Cernan rocketed into space three times, was the second American to drift weightless around the world on a tether, went to the moon twice, and shattered aerospace records on the Earth and the Moon. He also slid down a banister on a visit to the White House and once crashed a helicopter in the Atlantic while chasing a dolphin. Skimming the lunar surface in a rehearsal for the first manned landing, he erupted with salty language heard by millions when his craft briefly spun out of control. But he made spacewalks and romps over the lunar surface look routine, and in a way they were. 3.5 years after Neil A. Armstrong took mankind's first step onto the lunar surface in 1969, Mr. Cernan, a Navy captain and one of the nation's most experienced astronauts, landed with a geologist astronaut near the Sea of Serenity in the final chapter of the Apollo program, America's audacious venture to fulfill President John F. Kennedy's 1961 pledge to put Americans on the moon. Captain Cernan was the last of 12 Americans to set foot on the moon in 6 Apollo landings. 2 other missions were lunar orbital test runs, and Apollo 13 was an aborted landing after a malfunction. While Apollo 17 conveyed the drama of televised moonwalks, the awesome historicity of the Armstrong flight had faded, along with public interest in lunar missions that by 1972 had begun to seem repetitive. Still, his mission was a technological triumph. While Ronald E. Evans, a Navy commander, piloted a command ship in lunar orbit, Captain Cernan and Harrison H. Schmitt, the first scientists to go to the moon, descended to the virtually airless, soundless surface in a 4-legged lander that settled in a narrow valley of boulders and craters. After a 250,000-mile voyage from Earth, they put down 300 feet from their target. "The Challenger has landed," Captain Cernan announced in a broadcast to the world the Apollo crew saw hanging in the sky. "I'd like to dedicate the first step of Apollo 17 to all those who made it possible." He and Dr. Schmitt found themselves in a desolate but recognizable landscape near the Taurus Mountains and the Littrow Crater, a region of hills, cliffs, and escarpments littered with tumbled rocks. After establishing a nuclear-powered base station, they set up scientific experiments and began 3 days of explorations on foot and in a battery-powered rover mounted with a television camera. As color video pictures streamed across the Gulf of Space, the astronauts collected bluish-gray and tan rocks, 4 billion years old, drilled 8-foot heat probes holes, and journeyed to a 7,000-foot mountain called the South Massif and to the edge of a deep crater. There they found a fumarole, an ancient vent for volcanic gases, and collected strange orange and red soil samples. On 3 rover excursions, it took them 21 miles to craters, rock slides, and mountain walls, and in 22 hours of moonwalks, they collected 250 pounds of rocks and soil to carry home and left experiments that delivered data for years. The captain also scratched his daughter's initials, TDC, for Teresa Dawn Cernan in the lunar dust, a talisman that might last eons in a lifeless world. The mission completed, the captain took his last steps on the lunar surface and spoke for posterity. "America's challenge of today has forged man's destiny of tomorrow," he said in words slightly garbled on recordings. "And as we leave the moon and Taurus Littrow, we leave as we came. And, God willing, we shall return with peace and hope for all mankind." Dr. Schmitt climbed into the lander, followed by Captain Cernan, with a graceless farewell from the captain. "Let's get this mother out of here." The two astronauts blasted off and rejoined the orbiting command module. The trip back to Earth and the splashdown in the South Pacific on December 19, 1972, went like clockwork. In the decades since the Apollo program, the wonder of America's early achievements in space has been overtaken by space shuttles, international space stations, unmanned explorations of the solar system's outer worlds, and the possibility of a landing by humans on Mars. Captain Cernan's name has sometimes been linked with Armstrong's as the first and last humans to walk on the moon. But with budget constraints and other worlds beckoning, his lofty hopes for another generation to return have not been realized. No human has set foot on the moon in the 44 years since his mission, and there are no plans to return. Eugene Andrew Cernan was born in Chicago on March 14, 1934, to Andrew Cernan, a supervisor at a naval institution, and the former Rose Seiler. He graduated from Proviso Township High School in Maywood, Illinois, in 1952, and received an electrical engineering degree from Purdue in 1956, and a master's in aeronautical engineering from the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, in 1963. As a naval aviator, he logged 5,000 hours of flying time and 200 landings on aircraft carriers. In 1961, he married Barbara Jean Atchley. They divorced in 1981. He later married Jan Nana, who survives him, as do his daughter, Teresa Cernan Woolley. Two stepdaughters, Kelly Nana Toff and Danielle Nana Ellis, nine grandchildren, and a sister, Dolores Riley. Captain Cernan became a NASA astronaut in 1963. In his first spaceflight, Gemini 9, in 1966, he joined Colonel Thomas Stafford of the Air Force on a three-day orbital mission testing rendezvous and docking procedures. He also circled the world twice as a tethered spacewalker. At 32, he was the youngest American to go into space. His second spaceflight with Colonel Stafford and Commander John W. Young of the Navy in 1969 was Apollo 10. The final rehearsal for Apollo 11, which months later landed Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon. The eight-day Apollo 10 trip included a Cernan-Stafford descent in a lunar module to within 8 nautical miles of the surface. It did everything but land. It also photographed landing sites and sent back the first live color television pictures from the moon. Captain Cernan's final spaceflight, the capstone of the Apollo series, did not generate the worldwide excitement of the Armstrong-Aldrin adventure, but it did set records. The longest lunar landing flight, nearly 302 hours, and the longest lunar surface extravehicular activities, 22 hours and 6 minutes. Captain Cernan also set a career record of 566 hours in space, 73 of them on the moon's surface. After Apollo 17, Captain Cernan helped develop the United States-Soviet project Apollo-Soyuz. In 1976, he retired from the Navy and NASA and became an executive of Coral Petroleum in Houston. He founded the Cernan Corporation, an energy and aerospace consultant, in 1981 and was chairman of the Johnson Engineering Corporation from 1994 to 2000. Mr. Cernan, who lived in Piney Point, a suburb of Houston, contributed to ABC's coverage of space-related news, narrated and was featured in documentaries, and wrote with Don Davis an autobiography, The Last Man on the Moon, published in 1999. In 2010 congressional testimony, he and Armstrong, who died in 2012, criticized President Obama's plan to cancel NASA's program to send astronauts back to the moon and later to Mars and to invest in private companies for new space technologies. Mr. Cernan called the budgetary decision a slide to mediocrity and a blueprint for a mission to nowhere. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. We'll bring you our final segment of my interview with the late Gene Cernan right after this. You're listening to a memorial edition of the Best of the Book Nook, and we're ready to close it out with our final segment of an interview I recorded back in 2000 with the astronaut Eugene Cernan, who died recently at the age of 82.
Well, it's truly a powerful book, and I appreciate you finally informing me why so many of you guys like driving Corvettes.
Well, you know, I guess it's part of the nature. You know, why did I grow up wanting to land an airplane off an aircraft carrier? Some people think you're nuts. My mom, her little genie, her little baby, you can't go do that. You might hurt yourself. Well, what makes you want to do those kind of things? I'm still flying today, and I keep I dread the day when I take my airplane away from me, when I can say I can no longer fly. So I don't even talk about that. And you know, maybe it took a certain personality to do what we did. I will say this, though. I think you can go, particularly in those, say, first 30 or 35 astronauts, the first three groups of astronauts who are the nucleus of the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo program, and you look at any one of us and you will find 35 different individuals. I mean, we all had a common goal. We're all hitched to the same wagon, particularly when we had problems. We were competing against each other, tooth and nail, as friends, to get on another flight. But when an Apollo 13 accident comes along, or the Apollo 1 fire came along and we killed three guys, we all were hitched to the same wagon. We were all pulling in the same direction, and that was significantly important. And yet, when you examine all of us individually, you will find every one of us is different. Maybe there's some common threads. I don't know what they are. Someone smarter than me would have to find them. But we are truly individuals in our own right. Maybe that's what it took, because I've always felt that if you're going to do the job, you better do it better than the next guy. You know, better than it's ever been done before. And I think that's a credo which we, most of us, lived on.
Well, just like when you were on the moon, we have to be aware of the clock. And I'd love to talk about that experience you had on the moon before we let you go. That trip that you made to the moon, being the last man to walk on the moon, what an amazing experience for you.
Yeah, you know, it finally all fell in place for me, and that big gamble I took off paid off, and I did get my own crew. Not only did I get command of my own crew, not to give orders, but I think just to be accountable and responsible for something that was very important to me. But I also got to literally walk on the moon, and at that, somewhat of a dubious honor to be the last man to have left his footprints on the moon. And I say dubious because it's disappointing. This December will be 27 years, and I'm still the last man to have walked on the surface of the moon. Never did I believe, never, when I came back in 72, that we not only would have been back to the moon by now, but on our way to Mars by the turn of the century. Now my glass is only half full, not half empty. We will be, and we will go, but it's that generation that's in grade school today with the dreams that I had when I was a kid that is going to take us to Mars.
We've sure got the technology now. When you think about the stuff you guys were using, you know, the technology that you had.
You got more computing power in the dashboard of your car than we had to go to the moon.
Unbelievable.
But it was experience. You know, once you walk on the moon, you can never unwalk. I've always contended we left this earth not just physically but spiritually as well. And when you go out to the moon a quarter million miles away and you stand in sunlight looking at the earth, the beauty, the overpowering, awe-inspiring beauty, majesty of the earth, moving around there in a blackness, surrounded by blackness. You stand in sunlight looking at the earth surrounded by blackness, and that's a paradox on earth, but on the moon it's truth. And you look for the strings that must be holding it up, or the fulcrum that the earth turns on, and you can't find any. Yet it moves with logic and with purpose and with order beyond description. As you look from the icebergs of the north to the snow-covered mountains and the desolation at our pole to the south, you can look across oceans and continents, the blues of the oceans, the many varied colors of the blues, and the whites of the snow and the clouds, and one continent sort of goes around a corner, and 12 hours later, you're looking at the other side of the world. Nobody can explain that to me. I've always said it's just too beautiful to have happened by accident. There must be so much, much we have yet to learn about our existence here on Earth. You know, and you come back and you realize you're just not an inhabitant of the Earth. The Earth is not our home. The universe is our home. And I guess that's why I get so excited about thinking into the future, when we're going to learn more about this home of ours.
It's one of the best books I've ever read, for making you feel like you're there. It's just a great book. And you got good at walking on the moon, didn't you?
Well, we were there 75 hours, I guess. You know, unless you're a slow learner, you gotta pick it up sooner or later. Yeah, we made three major excursions, 7-8 hours on the surface of the moon, drove a car, landed in a valley that was surrounded by mountains higher than the Grand Canyon is deep. That's not a bad shot either, because we did land within about 100 100 yards or maybe less than that of our landing point, but the only reason we missed that was because of craters and boulders. But spectacular mountains. I think Buzz was the one who coined the surface of the moon, magnificent desolation.
Yep.
And they landed in the desert. We landed in these mountains in a valley 20 miles wide, 20 miles long, and 5 miles wide, and just overwhelming. And again, the Earth is always in the same place. The Earth never moves the whole time you're there. And our Earth, because we landed in the eastern edge of the moon, was in the southwestern. On top of the south, in a southwestern sky, on top of those mountains in that valley that I spoke of. And it truly became our own little Camelot for 3 days of our life. We did get pretty good. We got familiar with it. We knew where we were. It was home when the time came. We actually hated to leave, but you knew that time was going to come sooner or later. And here I am. 27 years later, and still carry that title, although I know somewhere, and I said it in the book this way, somewhere out there is a young boy or young girl with the indomitable will and courage to take us back out there where we belong. And I just hope I'm around to see that day come.
Did you hang on any of that orange sand? Did you hang on to any of that orange?
No, unfortunately, everybody thinks everyone who went to the moon has got a moon rock. There, and a guy who walked on the moon has got a moon rock. Whether that's in the realm of fairness or not, I don't know. But no, none of us have any of that. But we got more than that. We got a memory. We know we were there. As I think I said, once you walk on the moon, you can never unwalk it. Nobody can take that moment away from you. So the moon rock is just a material thing. The fact that you know what it feels like, you know that you were there. You know, I often look back and sometimes wonder if it wasn't a dream, and yet I knew when you almost involuntarily tried to steal looks at the Earth because it was so overpowering. That was your link to reality from a place where reality was almost like a dream. And I know I was there. I can recall being there, and yet, even at this point in my life, I wonder if that 13 years when I was in the space program really existed, or did I make it up? And that's what I said when I read my book, I wondered who I was writing about. Who is this person who grew up in such a common environment, blue-collar family, had a good mother and father, and had an opportunity to get an education, and then look what happened after that. The unreachable star is truly reachable, and that's what I try and relate to young kids.
Well, it's truly an amazing story and well told, and we really appreciate you taking time to share it with our listeners here.
Thank you, Vic. I appreciate your invitation to be with you.
That was an interview with Gene Cernan, who died recently at the age of 82. The last man on the moon, recorded back in July of 2000. Part of my Book Nook collection of original astronauts' voices. We had John Glenn. We replayed that interview recently after he died. And I did a couple of interviews with Buzz Aldrin. And fortunately, he's still with us. I've tried to get him back on the show. He keeps putting out books, and I have not been able to get him back on the show. After all these years, I kept thinking because I'd interviewed him twice, maybe that would give me some leverage. But they always say, well, if he was coming to Dayton, sure, we'd let you talk to him. But he's busy. So I'd love to catch Buzz one more time on the program, but we'll see about that. I am happy to say that of those astronauts, as I related when I replayed the John Glenn interview, I was able to get a signed copy of his book. All those astronauts were interviewed by phone, so it's kind of hard to get an autograph. His publicist got me a signed copy of his book, and I was even more fortunate with Buzz Aldrin because I talked to him twice, and I didn't get his autograph, and I was a little upset about it. And then one day, a woman, a folk singer, came in to play live on the station, and I had done some research on her, and I found out that she was Buzz Aldrin's stepdaughter. And so I told her how heartbroken I was that I never got his autograph. And she said, well, what's your address? And so I gave it to her. And the next week, I got a package from Buzz Aldrin out in Laguna Beach, California. And in the package was a photograph of Buzz, an official NASA photograph taken by Neil Armstrong on the surface of the moon, beautifully signed by Buzz Aldrin. And I treasure that. Now, Gene Cernan, my third astronaut, I never got his autograph. And that does make me sad. And I'm sad to say that he passed away recently, and we honor him today with our Best of the Book Nook. Speaking of archives, be sure to tune in tomorrow for the Book Nook as we bring you a very special interview with the gentleman at Ohio State University, Harry Campbell, who preserves old books. They have a massive archive over at Ohio State, and we're going to be talking to Harry about what it's like to take care of beautiful old books in the Book Nook. We'll be right back.